radioalburn.com.
Welcome to Truth Will Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 24th of January 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting live tonight at radioalbion.com, because we have with us the producer of Adolf Hitler, the greatest story never told, communism by the back door, the Freemasonic victory of World War II, and the soon-to-come Churchill's body count, Mr. Dennis Wise. Dennis, good evening to you.
I don't have the introduction with that line of... Mouthfuls.
Four of them to remember now. Four of them. Yeah. And still, nobody else has seen Churchill's body count yet but myself. And I was lucky enough to see the sec part two of it today. Is that still right? Nobody else has seen it yet? Just me?
No. Well, I haven't decided what order to do it in, but I've got to tell you this before I forget. I mean, the body count at the moment is like 1,800. And last week we talked about the Lusitania and the sinking, and we mentioned a millionaire called Alfred Vanderbilt, remember?
Oh, yes, yeah.
Yeah, he was one of the ones what was warned and took it as a joke and eventually died. Well, he was a railroad heir, believe it or not, but he died a hero. I thought, I've got to mention this because it's only fair, you know. Reportedly, what he did, he couldn't swim, but yet he still gave his life belt to a young woman passenger. So you got to say fair play, haven't you?
Wow, so he drowned in the incident. Yeah. He drowned, but he gave his life to somebody else, basically.
Yeah.
Gave up his life for someone else. So that's good going for a millionaire, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you at least expect that, don't you? Because they've got all the life to live, haven't they?
Yeah. Well, you're steaming into this, aren't you? Producing like a second episode within a week.
Yeah, I mean. You know, there's a lot of cover-ups. You know, you go to Wiki and the figures are altered and Piers Morgan lives in a dream world. And so it takes a bit of digging around, like, but I get there in the end. You know what I'm like?
How many sort of incidents are you going to look into then with Churchill's life, do you think?
Well,
how many would it be?
Probably the major ones, which is probably about half a dozen, maybe more. But he did some, like, you know, real... Like when he been at charge the miners, like that they still hate him down in Wales today, even though only two, possibly four were killed, but the official figure's two. And you know, that's a big thing in your own country when you're still being hated after 70 years, you know.
Yeah, well, that, I mean, what we're going to be talking about tonight is the Bengal famine, and you got 4 million that were killed there. And obviously, that, you know, that's a really big thing, and it needs to be talked about. But what you're pointing out there, you've got two miners that were killed by Churchill, but the effects of that were huge, and that individualizes it, doesn't it? It sort of brings it home when you're talking about something that was happening in our own country to our own people.
To our own people.
You can tell us the exact names of it. It's almost like, what's the word? When it's people in another country further away, it's hard to really personalise it.
That's right, but when it's at home.
Yeah, well, this is why the mainstream media, when they have these stories about refugees drowning, that like that picture of that one kid, the Turkish lad whose father wanted to get his teeth done at the dentist, and he took in Europe, and he's Cody, I think the kid was called, and he died on the beach. It was this boy on the beach, and they kept showing that because it personalised it, because it was just one person, and it personalised it. And when you have something like this, 4 million people died in the famine. You know, it's hard to comprehend it. And again, when you say about the two that were shot in the, you know, the miners' strike, I'd be very interested to learn about that one myself, to be honest. Yeah. I should know more about that.
I reckon it could have been four, but again, covered up. There was some rioting going on beforehand, which they forget to mention that the rioting was caused by, you know, the draconic wages they were on. And couldn't afford to live, you know.
Well, I think the king was very upset at that, wasn't he?
He was. You're quite right. Yeah, he invited into a house and did no food in. You know, I think she offered him a cup of tea or somewhat similar, but as far as anything to eat, there's nothing. The cupboard was bare, and the king was absolutely astounded. But don't forget, we still had workshops in 1947. Can you believe that?
Wow. Now, he was a real man of the people, wasn't he, that king? That's why they got rid of him. But you know, we should really save all that for when we talk about what happened in Wales. As we said, we're going to be talking about the Bengal famine today. So where did you find the information for this section of the new series, Dennis?
Usual channels. I googled around and scraped the surface, and then suddenly, like, you know, the wall falls down, like, and then you see a host of websites and backed up figures. And one of the most chilly ones is when the Indian historian come to Britain and found the archives.
Yeah, I'm surprised that was so late. I mean, it wasn't until about 2011, something like that. Yeah, you would have thought that something like that would have been done before, because I can remember hearing about the Bengal famine and knowing that Britain was blamed for it, but not really knowing, you know, the reasons why. But we'll get into them here, and we'll get into a bit more background information than it just goes into in the chapter in the new series. But what I've got here, I've got a transcript of the narration, and it's moved around a little bit so that it's a little bit more linear, and we can get into that and then discuss each section of it, I think. Okay, the Bengal famine was the greatest disaster to hit the continent in that century, and it was created by the British government under Churchill. Bengal had a bountiful harvest in 1942, but the British started diverting vast quantities of food grain from India to Britain, contributing to a massive food shortage in Bangladesh. With Burma's fall to Japan in 1942, India became the British Empire's major source of rice. It had previously imported 2 million tons of rice from Burma annually. Churchill casually diverted the supplies of medical aid and food that were being dispatched for the starving victims to the already well-supplied soldiers of the Allies in Europe. Despite refusing to meet India's need for wheat, he continued to insist that it export rice to fuel the war effort. Churchill could easily have prevented the famine. Even a few shipments of food grain would have helped, but he adamantly turned down appeals even from his own Secretary of State for India. Australian biochemist Dr. Gideon Pollier has called the Bengal famine a man-made holocaust because Churchill's policies were directly responsible for the disaster. And I'll just say, I've dug into this a little bit and looked at what the official story was. And part of it actually coincides with, you know, something that I say a lot, which is that when we went to the Third World and we gave them medicine and technology, it caused a massive explosion in population. And they weren't actually capable to look after themselves with that many people. Like, if you look at Africa, you've got some countries in Africa, half the population is under the age of 30. And they're all unemployed, and half the country is on food aid, and you had the same thing happen here in India. The population just massively exploded, and they didn't really have enough resources to feed themselves before this famine. There are reports of them being semi-starved, basically. And I think there was an increase of 40%, something like that. So they were in a bad situation already, and you know, this is what comes of interfering with other races. You know, the emotions come first. You think, well, we should give them this and we should give them that. But we're just making a rod for our own backs in the future, as we see now with the problems with population. And then you've got all this starvation that happens to these people. And you've got the same starvation that happens out there in Africa now. And on top of that, then you've got Churchill deliberately causing this for whatever reasons we'll get into. Do you want to comment on that, Dennis?
Yeah, what surprises me is how many starvation famines in how many countries there's been where we've been hanging around, like or Stalin, for instance, in the Ukraine. We would have got his orders anyway from the bankers. And then Ireland, we know about Ireland and the starvation there. And it seems to me that you've got to hold your hand up at some point and say that it's a weapon. I really do think that they use that against these people, maybe to control them or for whatever reason. But it happens too regular for me.
So you think there's a suspicious number of famines that occur around countries that have been colonized by, well, by the British Empire, by the bankers, basically, because you're bringing up Stalin there as well. And obviously what happened in Ireland.
And they're covered up as well, because Ukraine's sadly known about.
Yeah, and this was covered up.
Yeah.
So it does, but you say there to achieve an aim. I mean, what sort of an aim would it be? I mean, we know what the aim was here. It was to divert the food somewhere else. Do you think there was any other aim to it other than just greed?
Yeah. I think Stalin used the famine to break nationalism, imported a lot of Soviets into Ukraine, sent a lot to gulags or killed them, you know, and just changed the old, the old place, like from being Ukrainian, it became another part of Russia or the Soviet Union, should I say.
Well, there could be an element of that here as well. I mean, doing the background research into this, it turns out that there was this nationalist movement in India. And just prior to the famine happening, there had been demonstrations, there had been strikes, there had been civil unrest. The government tried to put the civil unrest down, and then there had been some sabotage. And this is all the while that there is a war going on, which obviously Britain is not going to take too kindly to. So there may have been an element of Churchill wanting to punish India for doing that, for daring to want to break free of the British Empire, which of course they did, and he's on record as saying that. And
and today you'll find Hitler. India is one of most countries where Hitler's probably most popular.
Yeah, they have Hitler ice cream over there.
Yeah, of course they do. Yeah,
Hitler ice lollies and all sorts. And they were supportive of National Socialism at the time. There was an Indian nationalist, I think his name might have been Bose or something like that.
Yeah. Who met Hitler, I think, didn't he?
Yeah, and he had a publishing company, and he was publishing books to encourage nationalism among the Hindus. I've got a copy of his version of the Mahavrata, which is where I first heard of him, and also Savitri Devi was involved with these people as well after the war. She was obviously a super fan of National Socialism. She never actually got to Germany while the Third Reich was going, but she went to India afterwards and hooked up with these Indian guys that were associated with the National Socialists at the time. So there was a lot of support for National Socialism and National Socialism itself, because of the Aryan interest and the origins of the Aryans. They were very interested, obviously, in India and Sanskrit and connections between Sanskrit and German. And I was going to say they'd be natural sort of allies with India, but once the war had started as well, once Britain was attacking the revolutionary movements, the nationalist movements, the movements in India that wanted the British to leave, they would have found a natural ally in Germany.
Well, when I did The Greatest Story Ever Told, I got a number of emails coming from India, and one in particular I can remember. He was a teacher, school teacher, and he said he's watched a documentary and he's now teaching it to his classroom.
Fantastic! that must have made you feel pretty good.
That's certainly wonderful.
But maybe one day, maybe there'll be quite a few classrooms that are showing it. Yeah, we can but live in hope. Well, let's get into some more of the details of this. Churchill's role in the Bengal famine. During the Second World War, the province of India was struck by a devastating famine. Starvation and disease killed up to 4 million people, nearly a tenth of Bengal's population. At the time, Indian and British governments blamed the provincial governments for failing to deal with the crisis. But recently, wartime correspondence has emerged to show that the real person to blame for these deaths is Winston Churchill, and the sources that we've got for that are the Times, the Telegraph, Time magazine, and the Independent. Because you have to think, famine is something that they were used to having in India. It had been happening there since 1770, particularly in Bengal. They had ways of dealing with it. So why was it that this famine was so destructive? Why did it kill a tenth of the population? There has to be some other reason for it. And as we'll see, Churchill was the reason for it. Do you want to say anything more on that, Dennis?
Yeah, that ain't it.
Hey?
Well, I was just going to say, Piers Morgan, who was a big Churchill fan, and that debate started me thinking about doing a documentary. And Wikipedia says 2 million died. Piers Morgan says 3 million died. Winston Churchill said 700,000 died. But the consensus is, from what I can gather, it's 4 million.
Yeah, the thing is, when they're writing in Wikipedia, they say 2 million died, but it's probably likely to be a lot more because of the record keeping. And you think these people, they weren't able to read or write. They probably never registered any births. How are you going to keep track of the how are you going to register the deaths? I mean, they had bodies just all over the streets, in the rivers. Nobody had the strength to bury them. Nobody's going to be able to keep track of it. So you can double the number that they've got, can't you? And what was this about Piers Morgan then? What is it you're referring to there? When was he talking about it?
Obviously, he's on Good Morning Television and has been for a while, I suppose. And there was a guy from a university up in Scotland who had tweeted something on when he was talking to Piers Morgan on Twitter. And Piers Morgan kind of abused him. And anyway, he ended up on the show. And Piers Morgan was giving his reasons why Churchill was a great man. It literally sounded like, you know, it didn't really matter if it was Jack the Ripper, all is forgiven, you know. But it's even worse than Jack the Ripper when you get down to it. I mean, the body count last week was 1,800. It's just gone up by 4 million this week. And I know there's some more to come.
It's such a shame that, you know, the person that is most put up as a hero to the British people was no hero. I mean, he was a horrible man by all accounts of it. He lost us the British Empire. He destroyed half of Europe. I mean, we've got fantastic people in our history, like Alfred the Great. Why isn't he put forward as a hero? Why have we got to have Churchill, who nobody liked? They didn't even vote him in after the war. He won the war. Yeah.
I mean, when Thatcher went to the Falklands, before she went, she was struggling. As soon as the victory at Falklands, she shoots up in the ratings. And anybody, I'm sure, who can win World War II should have shot up in the ratings. But I think the powers that be had enough of him. It handed Eastern Europe over to Stalin. Like you said, the empire was in tatters. And so he was put to grass, I think. Put to grass for a few years at least.
Yeah, he'd done what was required of him. I guess really you have to look at who Hollywood is promoting. If they are promoting somebody, then, you know, they're going to be the bad guy, basically.
it's certainly, you know, it's a fact, isn't it?
Yeah, it turned everything on its head. And if they're promoting somebody as a bad guy, then, you know, they're most likely to be the good guy.
Yeah, exactly.
You can even see that in Braveheart, when they've got Longshanks as the bad guy.
I'm surprised me when I learned from you that he was the one who got rid of the Jews, you know.
Yeah, he was a good guy. He was well liked by his people. Let's get back to this here. The famine itself. The famine was devastating, with people drinking the water the rice had been steeped in and eating leaves and grass. Dead bodies were everywhere because the living were too weak to bury them. Parents would throw their children into rivers and to wild animals to spare them a slow and painful death. Others committed suicide to escape the torment. Survivors were either lucky enough to find work in Calcutta or prostituted themselves. And that really, I mean, it's really far, far, far worse than this. There's reports of children picking through dung to find seeds, through fresh dung that somebody just watched it arrive, basically. And even cloth. They didn't have any cloth because the textiles had been taken for the British Army. So often you would have households and they would only have one piece of cloth between them. So women couldn't go out. They would just be sharing this piece of cloth, and the men couldn't go to work because they, you know, somebody else would be needing this piece of cloth at the time. You think, well, that sounds ridiculous. But there's records of that was the situation. It was that bad. It wasn't just food. It was textiles as well, even clothing that they had been deprived of, and it was completely unnecessary. We've got the build-up to the famine. the people of Bengal depended on grain crops to survive, especially wheat and rice. And in late 1942, a cyclone hit the region, destroying a huge amount of planted grain and triggering an outbreak of fungus that then laid waste to yet more crops. As a result, going into 1943, the food stocks in Bengal were far lower than normal. Still, there would have been enough if there had been a timely supply of food from elsewhere. But even before the famine, Churchill's policies had contributed towards it. In 1942, Japan took control of Burma, which is next door to Bengal. And to stave off the threat of invasion, Britain stationed troops on the border and evicted over 180,000 farmers and seized all their farmland for their base. They also seized all the boats in the region, banned all the shipping, despite a large portion of Bengal's food supply coming from the trade within that bay. Churchill also enacted a denial policy in the region, which is better known as the scorched earth policy, where rice crops and stores of grain were deliberately torched and destroyed by the army just in case the Japanese invaded and used them for supplies. Scorched earth policy. So the food was there and it was destroyed to prevent the Japanese from getting hold of it.
Yeah, they did the same in South Africa, didn't they?
Yeah, and this is who they were trading with as well. Bengalese were trading with the people from Burma, and they just stopped all of it. And there was also problems with prices as well, and people that were selling it at high prices on the black market, and there was taxes that were put on things. There was a lot of logistics as well, but the main problem was that all the farmland was destroyed. The farmers were all evicted in the main area where the crops were actually grown in. And then after that, you had this huge cyclone that hit. And this is before we get to the actual what little grain there was diverted to Britain.
Yeah.
So you've got like a catalogue of events here that are all leading up to it, basically. And it's just showing you that it could all have been averted, really. I mean, this scorched earth policy, and that's similar to Churchill destroying the French Navy, isn't it? We'll just destroy that so the French can't use it.
I think there were between 7,000 and 9,000 killed in that episode, I think.
He really had no concern at all for loss of life, no matter who they were. It didn't matter if they were white, if they were non-white, if they were British. It just didn't matter to him, other people's lives, just so long as he succeeded in what he was doing. I mean, for Churchill, the end justified the means. He had the communist mindset, really.
That's right. Yep.
I mean, that's what that is. That's the.
Well, they certainly weren't a Christian, were they? Let's be honest. He's actually proved that one.
No, well, certainly didn't live by Christian morality. So as we're saying, the food supplies the farms were destroyed, the food couldn't get in, and the food that was there was then diverted to Europe. India still exported 70,000 tons of rice for the British war effort in the first half of 1943, just as the famine was taking hold. This was enough to feed 400,000 people for a year. While Bengal was losing its food stocks, Britain was increasing its stockpile of food and raw materials to 18.5 million tons, while its population had 14 million people fewer than that of Bengal. And you do have to say, well, look, they were at war, and the European people have got to come first. You've got to make certain that Europe has the food that it needs before you feed the Indians. But, I mean, that is... Did we really need that much? 18.5 million tons? Did we really need to deprive India of theirs? I mean, all they would have had to have done was divert supplies there, the wheat supplies, or just left some of that rice there for them. I mean, that was enough rice to feed 400,000 people for a year. They only needed it for 6 months or whatever it was.
Well, they did the same to Germany, didn't they, after World War I?
Yeah, oh yeah, starving Germany. I'd forgotten about that. Starving Germany after World War II as well, didn't they, in the camps?
After World War II as well. So it's getting too it's too common for my liking.
Just remind us of the details of that, Dennis.
The World War One.
Yeah, both of them.
Well, they had the blockade on during the war because Churchill admitted like that he wanted to starve all the civilians. And that killed about a million. But then after the war finished, there was another media blockade, blackout, should I say, and the Germans, from what I can remember, a German went in to sign the Treaty of Versailles at one point, but when he saw what was on it, he just turned around and walked out, refused. And so it took a year of starving the Germans without the rest of the world knowing to get them back to the table again. Because, as you know, in Babylon Before Hitler, where it goes into the Weimar, and it shows, killing horses to eat and rats, and the German people weren't living at a high standard at all. You know what I mean? And that was the reason. So, obviously, eventually they come to the table, and then they were forced then to have the country split up, and the rest is history.
Was that a million died in that from the starvation? Oh,
I think about 700,000. For the second, after the war.
For the first
war. From starvation, which is a big, big number, say the war finished.
And then remind us again what happened in the Second World War at the end of that with the starvation there?
Well, it was much starvation.
In the camps?
There, it was more that they were sending them back, these POWs captured, who surrendered, the Cossacks got sent back, down in the Balkans, they all got sent back, certain death, and apart from the Germans' camps, Eisenhower's camps, they were starved to death. Starved in France as well. And if people want to argue the subject, why did the Americans change the prisoner of war status to enemy combatants, unarmed enemy combatants, I say? It's only one reason you do that, and that's to take all the rights away from the German soldiers. Then you can do what you want, and the Red Cross can't get near them.
And they did have the food for them. They had all these food packages for the Germans that were in the Rhine-Meadow camps, and they just didn't feed them. And they told the people that were on the outside, the villagers, that if they tried to feed them, they'd be shot.
They'd be shot, and some were shot at.
So this starvation
and them
thing...
And figures have been, altered as well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, getting back to this here, Sir Archibald Wavell and the Secretary of State for India, Leopold Amory, both requested that food be shipped to India to relieve the famine, but Churchill bluntly refused. He also refused offers of help from Canada and the United States. Australian supply ships sailed right past India and into Europe. Churchill would not let them divert into India to feed the starving population of Bengal. To make matters worse, Viceroy Linlithgow, the Governor General of India, believed the shortage of food was down to greedy Bengalese traders hoarding grain, and the provincial governments agreed with him. When the famine hit in mid-1943, every level of the government was neither able or willing to feed the people of Bengal. See, this was the thing. They didn't want to say that there was a famine because they thought that would cause people to start hoarding grain. So they didn't say that there was a famine, and they had a suspicion that it was because people were hoarding grain because they wanted to put the prices up, that's why people didn't have any food. So you had like everything that could go wrong seemed to be going wrong. I know that sounds suspicious, but I think it was like a load of things that converged together to actually cause this.
Well, Piers Morgan took that stance, and he said that I've got a letter here from Churchill to Roosevelt begging for help. I've got a letter here to the Canadian Prime Minister, Australian Prime Minister. But the problem was, this was a year after he'd been putting the block on it. And it's only because the photos started to go around the world and the world started to get wise. Now he's asking for help. But before then, nothing.
Yeah, I was just going to say this was actually after it had actually come out, because up until that point they were saying well there isn't a famine, don't say there's a famine because the traders will start hoarding their grain and they'll try and put the prices up.
Yeah.
So there was all this sort of thing that was going on there. And this Viceroy Linlithgow, he doesn't seem to have been very competent, if I can put it politely. And they were blaming the provincial governments as well. So they're all sort of blaming one another. These provincial governments, I think they were run by white people. They weren't run by the Indians themselves. So there was...
there was some black market and things going on.
Yeah, there was a lot of black market going on there. But this Indian lady that you mentioned, Indian journalist, I didn't manage to catch her name.
Madhushri Mukherjee.
Mukherjee, that's it, yeah, Mukherjee. In 2011, the Indian journalist Miss Mukherjee discovered that the death toll reached such heights because Churchill, who was in charge of Britain's vast empire, had refused to help them. She went to the UK archives and discovered that the files at the Indian office had been purged, but in the files at the Ministry of Shipping, she discovered that there were three War Cabinet discussions on sending food to Bengal in 1943. No food was scheduled at all to go to India, and Churchill was directly responsible for the lack of relief during the famine. Churchill's reasoning was simple. The starvation of anyhow underfed Bengalis is less serious than sturdy Greeks. And what he's saying there is that these Bengalis, they were half starving anyway, so they're not so important as sturdy Greeks, and by that I guess he means the Allies, the British. He's not just talking about the Greeks. He's just talking about whites there. So he's been quite open with his reasoning there. But there was no need to, you know, you could have fed the sturdy Greeks as well as the underfed Bengalis, just by giving them half their crops that they'd grown instead of taking them.
I think he said at one point, there can't be a famine down there because Gandhi's still alive.
Yeah, he really was quite flippant over it. Well, you can see that from his attitude. I'd like to see what the exact discussions were and what he was saying at them, because we don't have copies of that. Don't have copies of that. Churchill is known for having a racist disregard for India. He despised Gandhi and called Hindus a beastly people with a beastly religion. And... you know, you do have to say, well, they do have live animal sacrifices, and they do have prostitution temples, and there are a lot of very, very degenerate stuff that goes on with their religion. I mean,
it's just not a degenerate Freemasonry, though.
No, you make a good point there. It's a different kind of degeneracy.
Yeah, I guess. Right.
But yeah, that is a good point. You got the River Ganges there with these bodies and that are floating down it. You've got the Gauris that try to be as depraved as possible. They eat human flesh and drink out of skulls and you know and things like that. But then again, you've also got like the Jainist Buddhists who walk around with a little fly whisk because they wouldn't even want to hurt a fly, and they're just vegan, pretty much. But calling them a beastly people with a beastly religion, you know, I think the Indians are, you know, they're not a bad race. They got a lot of very, very bright, intelligent Indians, and I quite like Indians. They're probably my favorite one out of all of them, to be honest. Obviously they don't come close to whites, but out of them all, I think they're probably my favorite.
I don't think we're a white supremacy thing. I think Churchill was just like any Zionist. You know, they believe that if you're not Jewish, you're cattle. And I think that's just exactly how he looked at the Indians.
Yeah, he certainly looked down his nose at them. I mean, from the sound of that, you can see that he hasn't actually seen anything in them that is, you know, of any value. And they do have a lot of stuff that's of value. They're religious texts and their history. I mean, there may have been a different people when all that history was written and when they had their civilization, but they have still managed to keep that. They haven't just destroyed it all. They are still trying to follow the religions of their ancestors from thousands of years back, despite the Muslim invasions and all the problems that they've had. And you know, they've got their caste system, which is a good system, which is what we used to have.
I don't think castes. It's not that much different between the ordinary Briton and the Indian. I mean, he only wanted the British to fight the war for him, but I'm not convinced you know, the elite of this country, and Churchill was certainly one of them, you know, thought much of the British anyway. So, because they never, like we said before, they never benefited from the empire. Just they were just ideal people to take around the world and do the fighting.
Well, that's probably a good point as well. He probably saw, you know, the lower classes as being beastly people, as
sure
well as the Hindus. Regarding the crisis, he said, famine or no famine, Indians will breed like rabbits. So maybe a crude thing to say, but, you know, it is true. It is truthful. You know, we've
doesn't
got,
help the starvation, though.
But no, it's a nasty thing to say, but, yeah. You know, they were overpopulated. And this was the thing. They were breeding like rabbits, basically. So they did have a problem. But that's what comes when you give... When people don't come across the technology and the medicine themselves, and they're just given it,
yeah,
and they're given like an accelerated advance into civilization, they can't cope with it because they haven't learned it for themselves. It's just been given to them, and it causes problems. You know, we would have been far better off if we just left these other races to their own devices and said, look, this is their territory. We'll just leave them to do whatever it is they do. And yeah, it's only because of greed and wanting their minerals and you know what they actually
plunder.
Had there. Plunder, yeah, loot and plunder. That was the reason for it. But and then also on the other hand, you've got, you know, the people that really wanted to civilize them and, you know, the missionary types that wanted to bring Christianity to them and thought we could teach them to behave like ourselves and they'd be just like us. They've just got a different coloured skin and, you know, crazy ideas like that. And the end result of it is overpopulation, starvation, famine and resentment of white people.
Someone just cropped to mind. I wouldn't mind at some point looking at the British Museum, because I watched a clip not long ago and they've got plunder from all around the world. Some of the most incredible value, I mean, it's priceless, you know, that they picked up around the world. It'd be interesting to see just what is in there, because I'm sure they're not going to be giving it back.
Well, a lot of it, you know, don't forget, a lot of it was probably, you know, created by white people. And if it wasn't there in the museum, it would be destroyed. I mean, look at what ISIS have done. And this was the reasoning that they used was, well, look, if we leave this in the place where it is, the chances are it's going to get smashed up and sold and melted down as gold or just sold as diamonds, or it's going to get broken up and used as bricks for building houses with, because these people don't understand what it is that they've got, because it wasn't them that built the civilization in the first place. And this was the logic of why Britain has this museum that was filled with all this stuff. And now we're politically correct, we can't say, well, it was us originally that built this, or our race that built this. So then you get these people saying, well, we want this back now. But, you know, but it was, a lot of it was done out of a genuine desire of, this is just going to get lost to the world and sold and broken down as scrap if we don't put it in a place here where it can be looked at. So, there are two ways of looking at that.
Well, there is two ways of looking at it, but I think it's a hell of a job to try and get a Sphinx over from Egypt just to save it.
Yeah, well, that's a good example there, is the Sphinx and Egypt. I mean, you look at Tutankhamun, and they've done tests on these mummies, and they're, what, 99.99% exactly the same as Northern Europeans today. That shows you that the people that built the pyramids and built that civilization there, they were white, and it wasn't these Arabs that are there today. The Arabs used the pyramids as a urinal. You know, they haven't got that respect for it. They're not so bad now that it's a tourist thing. But it wasn't like that until Napoleon saw it all. And then you got Champollion, or whatever his name is, that went on the expedition and discovered the mummies. The people that were there, the Arabs, which it just, you know, breaking it up to use it for building blocks. It was only us that realized the value in it.
The other argument, of course, is, you know, ISIS went around destroying everything, but I'm pretty sure ISIS were funded by ourselves in America. But that's another story.
Well, yeah, it's not just ISIS either, is it? You know, look at the smashing down of the Confederate monuments in America. There's a certain strain
Sweden,
among our own people that wish to do that and destroy our past. Yeah. getting back here, India was no stranger to famine crises. They even had Indian famine codes for these situations. So again, they knew how to deal with this. This had happened many times before.
That's right.
But yeah, in this instance, none of it was put into practice for some reason. And Miss Mukherjee says there are two factors behind Churchill denying the food to India. Number one, he wanted to use the surplus food and the wheat that was in Australia not to feed starving Indians, but to store for future use in Europe. And number two, he had a personal dislike of Indians, saying in 1944 that he wished Indians didn't breathe so fast because that kept them from the doom that they deserved, which was extermination. And I think playing into that dislike of Indians was the fact that they wanted to leave the British Empire. And in fact, they did in 1947. They left the British Empire. So that was coming up pretty soon. So Churchill was thinking, I don't want to help these people. Why should I bother helping these people? They don't even want to be a part of the British Empire. Never mind the fact he was going to destroy the British Empire by the end of the war. But because he saw that as a rejection of Britain and the British Empire, he had this dislike of the Indians. He had no love for them. Well, had hatred for them, really, it seems.
Same with the Germans, really. He never sent any food to camps, did he?
No. Well, that's it, yeah. Yeah, you can look at that and say, well, he's an equal opportunities hater, yeah. I guess, Churchill was.
Well, at least
it didn't matter what race they were. Eh?
At least he's consistent.
Consistent, yeah. And we get to the censorship. News and pictures of the famine were censored in Britain, so the British public knew nothing about it. Even a sketchbook depicting it was banned by the British. Finally, in August 1943, the Statesman newspaper broke the censorship rules to publish photos of the famine victims, and the images shocked the world and action was taken. Now, I'll just stop there. The Statesman newspaper is actually an Indian newspaper, so it was actually banned in India to actually speak about the famine, not just in Britain.
Yeah, same in South Africa, isn't it? Same in Europe in World War One and World War Two. It's the same old, same old.
No, you couldn't even mention the word famine. It was that serious. Yeah. And
the British had no idea. The ordinary British public had no idea, because they are sympathetic to a lot of things. It's not in the nature, you know. Same with Americans as well. It's the government, the Freemason governments and the elite. These are the people who are heartless and cold and live for themselves.
Wasn't it with the Boer concentration camps that you showed that? They got exposed.
Again, they didn't know about it until Emily Pankhurst went over there, came back. And I still had a hell of a job to get the message out.
She's the suffragette. She's the suffragette, I think, Emily Pankhurst.
What she called? Yeah, I got it mixed up, haven't I?
It was another one. Yeah, it was another lady that...
it's another lady. I'll find out for next week.
Brought the news back, and the British people were disgusted at it and put a stop to it. But this here, this newspaper, it was a Calcutta newspaper, and it was actually run by white people. It wasn't sort of run by Indians. And the journalists were very brave to go against what... what Britain had been saying, to go against this law, this censorship law, and they risked all of that, and they did the right thing. They brought the images to the world, and action was taken. It was the same with the Holodomor. That was all covered up, and eventually there was one journalist that managed to get these pictures out, and up until that point, there was another journalist, and he'd been...
Saying the opposite,
and he knew what was going on, and he was reporting the opposite, trying to help the Soviets, basically. Really, really sick. I'm not sure if somebody was actually sort of saying the opposite here, and, the Bengalis are having a wonderful time, and, they've really advanced well and are living well.
It won't be a shock, really.
Like the workers' paradise in Ukraine
at this time, where
they're all starving. Anyway, the pictures were finally shown, the world was shocked, and Viceroy Linlithgow was replaced by Sir Archibald Wavell in October. He and Leopold Amory, the Secretary of State for India, requested India be given 1 million tons of grain. And that's a bit of a familiar name. Yeah, tell us more about that, Dennis.
Well, he was a member of the cabinet, and obviously John Amory was privy to what more than the public would have been, so for instance, education-wise and everything. And he obviously saw that siding with Stalin and the Jews, he didn't want to be a part of it. He was a nationalist. And so he went over to Europe and fought for Germany, hung when he got back. But his father stayed in the cabinet and, like I said, was head of India, Secretary of State, and begged Churchill at one point, but Churchill had nothing of it.
So what was he doing before then, John Amery's father? What was he doing before he was made the Secretary of State for India? Was he out there in India?
Yeah, I think he was, yeah. But I think he had spent time in Parliament, you know, with the Cabinet. Like. Pretty high up, you know, for John Amery to do what he did would have upset a lot of people.
Well, yeah, it's very interesting that this was 1943. I mean, this is right at the height of John Amery's fame as a political dissident, basically.
Right.
And yet, you know, it didn't affect the family here. I mean,
No, it didn't affect Amery in charge. It looks like his father had a bit of a heart as well.
Well, it's different to today, isn't it? I mean, you look at the left, they'll try and find out who somebody's family is so they can go and attack them.
Exactly.
And even here, when you've got, you know, a man as wicked as Winston Churchill, you know, he's still promoting the father of somebody who's, you know, ostensibly his political enemy.
Yeah.
And I wonder what John Amery knew about the system, if he'd grown up with the system.
I think he knew a lot about the system. That's why he came to the decision he did do. I think most of the British public knew the real story of why we were going into war against Germany. They wouldn't have gone to war neither.
Well, you should imagine his father was probably, you know, like father, like son. His father was probably a good man, brave, courageous
man. Yeah,
he had a career, didn't he? Well, and also he managed to sort this out straight away. I mean, this Viceroy Linlithgow, who had spent the previous year, you know, messing things up, he was replaced by Leopold Amery, and straight away things were sorted out. He requested 1 million tons of grain. He wasn't given that. In the first 9 months of 1944, Churchill arranged for 350,000 tons of wheat to be shipped over. And he also asked Roosevelt for another 50,000 tons, but America was unable to divert ships to India. Luckily for Bengal, the harvest of December 1943 was enough to end the famine, along with the belated supplies from abroad. And if you have a look at the Wikipedia page, it's got quite a lot of details about what this Leopold Amery had to do in order to ensure that the grain got to the right people, so that it wasn't just taken by these merchants and then sold at high prices. You know, they had to cope with all of that as well. Because you had a system in India, you had this one group of people that were extremely rich, Indian merchant types, yep. And then you had the really poor types as well. And they had to ensure that the grain went to the right people and that it got transported to the right place and it wasn't hijacked along the way. And apparently he did very well with that. So that's, you know, if I had more time, I would have looked into that a little bit more. About that side of it. And then we've got what Churchill's supporters say. Churchill's family and defenders claim that he was not responsible and he was just doing his best in an awkward situation, understandably prioritising Europe's supplies first. They blame the Indian government for failing to plan for and alleviate the crisis, even though they had an established procedure for doing so. Yet documents prove Churchill was unashamedly callous towards India, and his friends wrote about his racism towards them. India was well on its way to independence by this point, therefore Churchill didn't see the point in helping a people who didn't want to be a part of the British Empire. You know, and they have got a point here, Dennis, because they did have plans of what was going to happen if there was going to be a famine, because they'd had plenty of famines before. So yeah. He was blaming the Indian government for not implementing those plans. But I think part of those plans were to get shipments of grain from Australia.
Well, it helps.
Yeah, to import it from elsewhere. But what Churchill was doing was getting that grain from Australia and getting it to come straight to Europe. And there's also another way of looking at this. Because it was right in the middle of the war, there was going to be some part of the world that was going to suffer. because of the supplies being needed all in one part of the world and being taken from all the other parts of the world. So there was going to be one part of the world that was going to suffer. And it was just happened to be that it was India. It didn't just happen to be it was India. I mean, it was because Churchill decided it was going to be India. But if it hadn't have been India, it may well have been another part of the world that ended up not having enough to feed its people because it was all being taken for somewhere else. I know it's a weak argument, but that is another argument that's put across for it.
Well, Churchill's family and defenders can give excuses for all they like, but I can assure you the body count, by the time this series is finished, they're going to be struggling for excuses, I'm telling you.
Are you going to include, all the Germans and the Axis people that were killed by him, or how are you going to differentiate between, Churchill's body count?
Well, the American camps, that's Roosevelt. It's all to do with the bankers, but I think Churchill, you get certain leaders like Stalin and Churchill who kind of revel in this kind of role. Like Stalin once said, One death, or a million deaths is nothing. Something on them lines. He just had no heart. Likewise, Churchill is one of these as well, and probably Roosevelt was as well. So you can find out who's responsible if you dig deep enough. And certainly, like you said, the French Navy, and things what went on after World War II, after World War I, during World War I. They're really going to be struggling, I think, for excuses. And rightly so, really.
So you're going to sort of cover things that were outside of normal warfare then? That sort of thing?
Well, I suppose whatever he was responsible for, and there's bodies, then he's responsible, and I'll probably log it. But I may have to do something like I said, the miners who, like you said, it was the reaction since... just by doing something like that to his own people, even though they're just a couple dead, maybe four dead, I'll probably combine that with another set of events which didn't really have a great loss of life, but the event itself, to do to your own people proves what he were, really. He were a supremacist, but I don't think he was a white supremacist. I think he was a Zionist supremacist.
I think he was out for himself. Because don't forget, he wrote that piece, didn't he, and exposed that Bolshevism was all being run by Jews.
That was that.
And the conspiracy was all run by Jews. And then the focus group bailed him out, and they gave him loads of money so that he could keep hold of that house that he lived in, and he could keep his housekeeper and everything else. And then after that, the focus group helped to promote him and publicise him and got him into office so that they could use him. And he was beholden to them. And it was after that he became this supporter of Jews and Zionism. That's what I was saying. There was like a change there. That's why I think he was just out for himself. I'm not sure if he even fervently believed in Zionism. Maybe he was just...
Well, there's a statue of him in Israel, so they must have believed in him.
Yeah, well, that's a good point.
If I could just say, Napoleon came out with a saying once, which is as true as daylight tomorrow. People can be easily moved by self-interest and fear. And that's exactly what Churchill was, self-interest.
But he's put across as this great British patriot, isn't he?
Great well, British Hollywood patriot. Building him up to be this, yeah. But I still say, on that day, on the balcony of Buckingham Palace, when the crowd out there celebrating World War II and was a white sea of Anglo-Saxon, he knew exactly what was going to happen.
Well, he spoke out against immigration as well.
He can speak out here, against immigration all he wants, but he won the Kalergi Prize.
That's what I mean by he just went along with whatever he was told, wherever his bread was buttered.
I mean, he said about Christianity, didn't he? We were fighting alongside the biggest Christian killers ever, the Bolsheviks. So
yeah, that's what I mean. His words really don't have
mean
any
nothing. Yeah,
yeah, they have no meaning to them, and yet he's put across as this great speech maker, and people quote his speeches.
Were drunk half the time. They had a double, I think, didn't they?
Yeah,
they had a double.
They had a double that spoke for him because he was hammered.
Says it all.
I did hear he used to wear women's underwear as well. That was something else that was
and he was
autobiography,
homosexual, yeah. and like little children.
Well, he went to one of those private schools, didn't he, where a lot of dodgy things went on. There's a good book about that as well, about Churchill's Headmaster, I think it is, by Ed Dutton.
Really?
Which might be worth looking into.
Yeah, yeah.
I should imagine he digs up lots of interesting information that people weren't really aware of.
Well, he's related as well to Roosevelt. So it's all bloodlines. And like you said, in World War One, they both had these jobs simultaneously rising to be leaders of the country, obviously because the bosses are the same. But yeah, you know, all this bloodline thing, they all keep it in the family, don't they? Which is why we don't get a look in.
Well, he didn't really have any success in war either, did he? This was the thing. He was known for being a total failure.
Not playing for Singapore.
What happened there?
In World War II for Britain.
What happened there? Remind us, what happened there, Dennis?
Well, the Japanese, like he were blaming all the commanders, but it was him who said that he didn't think the Japanese had come through the jungle because they had 100,000 soldiers defending Singapore and 30,000 Japanese went through the jungle, caught them by surprise, and took Singapore.
And I should imagine that was a very important part of the British Empire. It's a very important port there. Very, very important place. But in the First World War, in the First War, he was a failure. And in the Boer War, there was something that went on. I forget what it was. The battle or something, and it was a total failure. And he lost lots of men, and he really never should have, should have seen public light again.
But yeah, what's he doing in charge of anything? I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Have you got any ideas what part three or the next section is going to be about?
I've got some. Ready for backups, but I haven't settled on rooting around yet. I'm not sure if you had anything to do with Gallipoli or not.
Yeah, that was the one I'm trying to think of. Gallipoli, yeah.
Was it really? All right.
Yeah, I think so. Yes.
Another mass sacrifice.
I think that's the one I'm thinking of. So what you're going to do is you're going to make these all up separately, and then work out which order you want them, and then possibly put them out as a feature length. Film sort of thing.
I might even use the sound bites from the Piers Morgan debate.
Right, right. So you could end up with like an hour long, movie type thing, or 90 minutes, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's the intention.
Make a nice change.
Then people, they're not tripping up finding things. It's all there, just like Greatest Story Never Told's there.
Yeah, good idea. And we mustn't forget that he's on all our £5 notes now as well.
There's a shock.
But that does give you, does give you a chance to talk about it, though, doesn't it? I mean, if you're, you've got to pay somebody some money, you pull the money out. Look at this, Winston Churchill. Yeah, the mass murderer, the guy that lost us the British Empire, the guy that caused the Lusitania to be shot by the Germans, killed 4 million Bengalis horrifically with a famine. You can sort of bring this stuff up and wake people up.
If you know
up.
About it.
Yeah, well, it gives you an excuse to do it, doesn't it?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, that's the reason, really, because it did get to me when Piers Morgan were, like I said, it didn't really matter what he'd done, who he'd done it to, how many he'd done it to, in what way he'd done it to, as long as he won that war. And he didn't win the war anyway. I mean, we know the Americans came in the First World War and the Second World War, and the troops themselves did the fighting. He never saw any fighting. He said he fighting in the First World War.
You can't really say that anybody won that war. All you can say is that the white people lost the war.
Yeah, exactly. Which he didn't care about.
Basically Britain against Germany. Who can win? If you it's like one brother fighting against another brother. How can you say that who can win? The family loses out either way. If you've got two brothers fighting against one another, the family can only lose. They can't win.
And this thing about civilians as well, that's another one, I guess.
What's that about? What not wanting to kill civilians when he was
in Germany.
Yeah, he was the worst one of the lot, killing civilians.
Exactly. Didn't care if they're Indian, German, or whatever.
Well, starting with Lusitania that we said about, and the changing in the naval rules about, instead of rescuing people, instead of the submarine appearing,
he wanted Americans dead, didn't he? To rescue them. War.
They changed it so the submarines couldn't risk surfacing because they'd be attacked, so they couldn't rescue the people. So they just had to shoot the boat, regardless of civilians that were on there, regardless of the loss of life. That was down to
this guy. How evil is this guy?
Yeah, he's one of the worst. He's there with Stalin, isn't he?
And he said, didn't he, history's going to be kind to me because I'm going to write it.
Very true.
Well, leave it out more than anything.
Well, I think really there were some left alive to tell the tale, the true story of what went on. Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Dennis.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. Don't forget, we do have a Bitcoin wallet and we do require your donations to keep Radio Albion going. We'll be back next Friday with more Truthful Out Radio for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.
RadioAlbion.com